Blog Talk Radio.
What are you doing up here? You been benched yet?
I have some real first in my professional career. I've been benched.
Why is that?
I won't fight.
Well, you could play if you fought.
All right, the switchboard's down. So welcome, everybody, to the Third Man In Radio. Here I am, Chris Block, writer, editor, and keeper of the thirdmanin.com, here on this Monday night, April the 4th, 2011. It is 8 o'clock here in Chicago, and we're here to talk about a lot of things tonight. Blackhawks in Montreal tomorrow night, Tuesday night, for what is just a gigantic matchup, as it turns out, for a lot of different reasons on both ends. Also, tonight we're going to talk more about the week ahead of the Blackhawks. Wednesday night, St. Louis Blues come to town trying to play spoiler. And also the Detroit Red Wings on the weekend, the back-to-back to close out the 2010-11 season. We'll also talk NHL awards and a whole lot more. Superstar, are you there?
I am.
You excited about tonight, Superstar?
I am. I'm jacked. Let's get this. Let's light the candle on this pitch.
Are you ready to give out full maximum effort? You're going to compete in the corners tonight?
Unlike the hometown team, yeah, let's compete and give a full 60-minute effort.
All right, to help us go to the net and do whatever we would do when we got there in the crease. From the Breakout Hockey Program, he was with us back on January 31st, right after the All-Star break. Actually, just looking, recalling that now, that was on the eve of Snowmageddon, which I, on this very show, proclaimed was a farce, and just another case of when Block is wrong, we got hit with 26 inches of snow. Adam Summers, how you doing tonight, Adam?
Doing very well. Thank you guys very much for having me back on the show. And yes, the Snowmageddon, the last time I was on, you, as everybody knows, you sadly ended up being wrong. I was actually thinking about that as I was driving home. I think it was around 2:30 in the afternoon, right as the snowstorm hit, and it took me about 4 hours to get home. So yeah, you a little bit off the mark there, but we all survived.
Yeah, I think my normal commute of about 15 minutes took about 25 minutes that day, but. Yeah, I feel awful for the people to do. I used to have to do a commute like that, and yeah, I'm glad I don't. But I don't believe there's snow in our future. It was a beautiful day out yesterday, at least. Today it was okay, and it's playoff hockey time. We hope. one of the reasons why we have you on, and for the folks that were with us the last time you were on, Adam, is you do have a dual personality. On one hand, you're a Chicagoan. A Blackhawks season ticket holder who doesn't just focus on the Blackhawks. You got the Breakout Hockey program over there at breakouthockey.podomatic.com. You talk about the league in general, but the other side of that personality, you are a huge Montreal Canadiens fan, follow the team, watch all the games. Why don't catch us up to speed a little bit on the Canadiens? They had a brilliant first half of the season. Carey Price on a roll, hit the skids there for a while. What's up with the Montreal Canadiens these days?
Yeah, it's been a roller coaster ride, and you had to expect that at some point in the season this was going to happen. There's sort of an oversimplification in terms of the perception of the team, which is they'll go as far as Carey Price takes them, which there is some truth to that. But the biggest thing that's gone wrong, really, is the accumulation of injuries on the blue line. Everybody knew about Andre Markov going down early in the season after missing the majority of last season, coming back and then getting injured in the playoffs last year. But not only did Markov go down, Josh Georges, who one of the more unsung defensemen in the NHL, a guy that show up on the score sheet all that much. I mean, he's not going to be in Norris Trophy consideration most years, really any year to this point in his career, but an incredibly steady guy that is a leader in the locker room. He went down. You also had Yaroslav Spachek go down for the better part of a month. He still is not back yet. So you had a blue line that had three solid, and in the case of Markov, much better than just solid defensemen, all go down, and they've had to try to fit guys in like Yannick Weber. They reacquired Paul Mara, who they had last year. They acquired Brent Sobel, who everybody listening to this show is pretty familiar with. So a lot of pieces have been shuffled around, and it's taken its toll, and it's also, I think, you've got a situation where Jacques Martin, he runs a very tight system. He demands a lot of his players as far as restraint. They're a team that – they're a puck possession team, but they're also a team that will really sit back and wait at times and wait for their opponents to make that first mistake. And if you have a couple guys on the team that aren't on board, I think like it's pretty safe to say Scott Gomez, for example, the majority of the season has not been on board with that system. It throws everything out of whack, very different from when everybody was on board last year in the playoff run. So it's been a bit of a struggle as of late.
Hey, let's update on those injuries since you did mention them. Obviously, Markov, Georges, those guys aren't expected back at all, are they?
Well, Markov, it's interesting because they're publicly saying there's no chance of him coming back, but he's been skating the last couple of weeks. Today, actually, he was skating not on the same sheet of ice as the Habs, but he was skating with Alexander Picard, who has gotten in some games this year as well. So he's moved from just skating simply on his own to at least having a bit of a D partner out there with him. The only scenario I see it really being possible is if they go on another miracle run and they get to the finals. Maybe Markov will try to push it like he did last year in the playoffs, but he's got a lot to lose. He's a free agent at the end of the year, and it's a situation where they want to bring him back. He wants to come back, but it seems as though the money figures, the demands may be pretty far apart at this point. So, yeah, I don't expect him back. And Georges, it would take a minor miracle. He had the same injury that Markov did, but a couple months later. So can't imagine him coming back at all.
Okay, let's break down the defensive pairings as you're going to see them tomorrow night for the Montreal Canadiens. I don't know that there's necessarily a 1-2 pairing, but P.K. Subban and Hal Gill are paired up together. James Wisniewski, Blackhawks fans know him very well, and Roman Hamrlik, they're together. And then the third pair, I guess you could definitely say, is Brent Sopel and Paul Mara. Now, Jaroslav Spacek, at least there was some thinking that he would come back for the game on Tuesday night. That's been pushed back. He's ruled that out. Where does Spacek fit into that six? And who sits out when he's ready?
Well, I would imagine if and when he does come back, you may see the Hamrlik Spacek, the old man line defense pair reunited. But they actually, even though they are of quite advanced age, they did play very well earlier in the season. And I could see that happening. I would think on that the third D pair, it's either going to be Sopel or Mara. Sopel is one of the guys on the team that is playing injured. I believe it was a hand injury that he sustained on a shot block, I think 5 or 6 games into his run there. So I would think whichever of the two of those is more banged up would probably come out. I know that Paul Mara's fit in a lot better this year than he did last year. He's not the most fleet of foot, certainly a little bit faster than Hal Gill, but he seems to have grasped the system a little bit better. So I would say Sopel may end up coming out, but again, he's a guy that is very, very valuable in the playoffs in terms of penalty killing. So I think health will determine a lot of it.
Up front, and I want to save Max Pacioretty, and we'll update his status here for the next discussion that we're going to have in a minute. But up front, since we went through the D pairings, it's Scott Gomez between Brian Johnson, Matthew Darche, Thomas Plekanec, Mike Camilleri, and Andre Kostitsyn. Lars Eller, Ryan White, Tom Pyatt, and David Desharnais with Travis Moen and Benoit Poulier. Two guys in particular I know that when I watch Montreal that I think are particularly interesting these days. What we know about Montreal is they can outskate you. If the Blackhawks want to get into a track meet tomorrow night with Montreal, they could have a problem. Because Montreal will play at least 3 lines where the Blackhawks are going to rely on 2. But two guys that I think are could be difference makers tomorrow night are Darche and Desharnais. Talk about those two and what they've meant this year to the team.
Yeah, you're definitely speaking my language bringing both of those guys up. Matthew Darche, just strictly from a fan perspective, maybe my favorite guy on the team, one of my favorite stories of the last couple of years. This is a guy that is, I believe, 33 years old, pretty much a career minor leaguer. He had a cup of coffee a couple years back with the Tampa Bay Lightning, a guy that played collegiate hockey, actually, in Quebec. He's a Montreal guy. Came on board last year through the Hamilton Bulldogs, basically because of all the injuries. Came up, and it was clear that they didn't have long-term plans for him, but just his hard work, his willingness to go to the front of the net, willingness to pay the price, and also I mean, he's certainly not Sidney Crosby, but he does have skill. He's got good hands. He's a good passer down low. He's a guy that even this year they tried to they picked up Dustin Boyd. Everybody figured that would leave Garcia possibly odd man out, even though he was on a one-way contract, and he earned the spot over Dustin Boyd. He's a guy that you're not going to see him make a ton of flashy moves, but he, just for example, the last game, actually, he had two goals, both assisted by Brian Gianta, that were basically mirror images of the exact same play. Gianta coming down one end, basically drawing the defender over and just flipping the puck at the net, and Darsh both times knocked it out of the air and put it into the net. So if goals by Montreal are scored in front, Darsh is probably going to be the guy that's going to put them in. As far as David Desharnais is concerned, another guy that is a bit of an unlikely success story, a very small guy that has excelled in every other level that he's played in pro hockey. He was the leading scorer in the ECHL a couple years ago. He was the leading scorer in the AHL this year when he got called up by Montreal. And he's a guy who's small, like I said, but he doesn't play a little guy's game. He's got good hands, but he's very, very willing to go to the front of the net to put pucks in the net. And also, again, a guy who's another good playmaker. So it's an interesting dynamic because you've got guys like Desharnais and Darsh who have been great this year. Darsh has had some injury problems, but they've both been great. Then on the flip side, you've got guys like Scott Gomez who have certainly not been great. Only 7 goals, a little bit surprising after how well he played in the playoffs last year, even though he's certainly been more cold than hot the last several years of his career. So without a guy like Desharnais and Darsh as well, Montreal would be in serious trouble, I think.
The guy that Montreal picked up in the trade for Yaroslav Halak, Lars Eller, now, you know, it's a young kid coming in. Actually, I guess we could probably compare him a little bit from a Blackhawks perspective to Marcus Kruger. Talk about Eller's season, and just recently he started to come around a bit, has he not?
He has. The last few games of this last little stretch that they've played, he's had a little bit of a return to his pension of bad penalties, but I guess you can make the comparison to Kruger a little bit. He's had a little bit more North American experience, but he's also been in an incredibly difficult situation. He's the, like you said, the key cog in the Yaroslav Halak trade, and the expectations for him, even if they were completely unfair, they were there. And I guess one comparison that you could make to Kruger that I think is pretty accurate is that he's a guy who, he does have offensive talent. He's not a guy that's really ever going to put up 30, 35 goals, but he's a heck of a playmaker. But it seemed early in the season as though he was a bit hesitant to take any chances to really try to make plays. And maybe he was overthinking the game. Maybe the pressure of being the return for Yaroslav Halak had gotten to him, and he just didn't want to make mistakes. And in the end, it seemed to cause him to make more mistakes. So it's a bit of a work in progress with him, and it also it seems as though he plays a lot better when he's out there with veterans. He spent some time on a line at times with Helfern and Darsh earlier in the year when everybody was healthy, and they looked very good together. So certainly not as shaky as he was at the beginning of the season, but I still think there's room to grow for him.
I guess staying with the comparisons between the Blackhawks and the Canadiens, I think one of the things that people will see tomorrow night, and we joke oftentimes, a lot of us who follow hockey, about the Canadiens, how small they are. They're quick, they're small, but there are similarities in how Montreal wants to score goals. I mean, and there are slight differences. A lot of Montreal's offense is generated from perimeter, but two guys that we talked about, Darsh, Desharnais, Travis Moan, these are guys that actually do go to the net for the Canadiens, and a lot of their goals actually are scored on the back door. Whereas I think the contrast to the Blackhawks are constantly attempting to pass to the back door, whereas the Canadiens will shoot to the far side and they'll have a guy over there for the rebound. So that's something the Blackhawks have to be concerned about tomorrow night. I wanted to talk about Plekanec, Camilleri. These are guys that I know have been playing through injuries. Like, how healthy are they today? And, you know, as we wrap up, tomorrow night is the Montreal Canadiens' home finale. They'll finish up with Ottawa and Toronto, and that's it for them. How healthy are they going into the playoffs?
Yeah, I think that's a big part of the problem is that, like you mentioned, both Plekanec and Camilleri. I think Camilleri may be a little bit closer to being somewhere near 100%. If you remember, he had missed a good portion of the season with a shoulder injury and came back to play in the Heritage Classic. My assumption, just from having watched him play, is that it was very similar to a couple years back when Patrick Kane came back to play. Granted, he hadn't missed as much time as Camilleri, but when he came back to play in the Winter Classic and just didn't look 100% or anywhere near, but obviously wanted to play that game. That seemed to be the same way with Camilleri. He seems to be closer now. Plekanec, I think, I don't know exactly what the injury is. They're, not surprisingly, being very tight-lipped, but I get the impression he might not be really fully healthy the rest of the year. He got injured several weeks back and came back for the drubbing that they took in the very heavily hyped rematch against Boston after the Pacioretty hit. And really, he's had a few games where he started to look like himself, but you could tell that there's something missing. There's something wrong with him. And even on the back end, the guys that are quote-unquote healthy, quite a few of them are nicked up. Hal Gill missed several games. Montreal had a scare with P.K. Subban a couple games ago where it looked like he might have gotten nicked up. James Wisniewski, if you've seen any of the games recently, anybody that's listening, he has had a full face shield for quite a while, actually. Another injury that happened just prior to the Winter Classic, a nasty gash on his cheek. And as weird as it sounds to say that his game has suffered because he's wearing the full face cage, maybe it's just coincidence, but he hasn't been quite the same player, and maybe it is the cage because he seems to, on the power play, have a little bit of trouble picking up the puck when it's at his feet. Same thing when he's trying to make a play in his own zone. So a lot of guys out and a lot of guys who you would think if the situation was different and maybe other guys weren't, sitting out for large portions of the season with injury, guys like Plekanec, Camilleri, Hamrlik, Gill, they might be out as well.
You know, you brought up the Boston game, and I want to get into Pacioretty in a second after we talk about this. But, another comparison to the Blackhawks, the up-and-down season of Montreal of late, even before the 7-0 drubbing, in Boston. Two games before, Montreal goes into Minnesota and cleans house there, 8-1. Their very next game back at home, they get shut out by the Buffalo Sabres. Then they go to Boston, the 7-0. They get shut out in Washington. Then they get the bag skate. They beat Atlanta. Then they get beat up pretty good in Carolina. They come back on Saturday night, their most recent game before they face the Blackhawks. They beat the Devils 3-1. Can you compare the two? As someone who does obviously follow them, is closer than anybody that would follow these two teams. How would you compare and contrast the two seasons, Blackhawks and Canadiens?
I think you mentioned this as well in the email earlier that we traded, that they have basically identical records, and the, like you said, the up and down nature of the seasons are similar, but how they've gotten there is pretty different. I think with the Blackhawks, a lot of it has been mental, whether that's an excuse or not, but a lot of it has been mental. People say Stanley Cup hangover, and you can dismiss that, but there's also something to it. There's something to bringing in, and again, it's an excuse, but bringing in so many new players, I found it interesting that it seems in some ways that the guys that they acquired right around the deadline seem to have fit in a little bit quicker than some of the guys that were brought up from Rockford or who came or just came in, guys like Victor Sahlberg, guys like that, at the beginning of the season. Whereas with Montreal, I think a lot of it, again, goes back to, it seems like whenever they have success for a couple games in a row, playing, again, this very tight system where, it's like you said, they do run and gun, they do move the puck, but they also, a lot of times when they get a one or particularly a two-goal lead, they will go into shutdown mode. Certainly not to the level of Tampa Bay like we saw on Sunday night here in Chicago, but that's what they do. And it seems like after they string together a couple of wins, guys like Gomez, early in the year, P.K. Subban, who certainly has got under control as the season's gone on in terms of playing in the system, but you get guys who, they want to freelance a little bit. They want to try to create a little bit more than the system allows, and it throws everything off. It throws off the entire way they play, and I hate to keep picking on Scott Gomez because he's certainly not he's not the only reason that they've had an up-and-down season. But when you've got a guy who, due to the circumstances of his contract, they are compelled to play him top two-line minutes and try every possible combination of guys to go along with him, and rather than those guys getting him going, it seems as though whatever line he's on usually ends up being the line that starts taking a back seat. So it's been a little bit different. I still think the Blackhawks, if they get into the playoffs, I would think they can do a little bit more damage than Montreal can. Again, the great equalizer, though, is Carey Price. It's, like I said, it's an oversimplification to say he's the only thing that makes the team go. But if he can go on a run like Halak did last year, I mean, who's to say they don't find themselves in the conference finals again?
I just hope from a Blackhawks perspective, when you do your advanced scouting of the Montreal Canadiens, that they have that, you know, that patented play where Scotty Gomez takes the puck in neutral ice, he flies up his off wing, and then he cuts at the top of the right circle, back passes it, you know, to whether it's a forward or an oncoming defenseman, and then he floats into the far circle for that backdoor rebound. I just envision that being a big problem tomorrow night for the Blackhawks. We know how much they like to watch the puck. We know that they have a problem with stuff in front of that and rebounds on the backdoor. I just hope that they have that scouted for their sake. Let's talk about Zdeno Chara.
I thought I was done with that, but I'm happy to talk about it. I did about 40 minutes on that about a month ago, but no, I'm always game to talk about that whole incident.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't had a chance. I mean, we've tried, but you know, with so much going on, we only do this once a week. It's been a little bit. I just haven't had a chance to talk about it, but I want to get your perspective because it comes up again this week with the Boston Bruins and the Chicago Blackhawks and this perceived. You know, Sean Thornton is a hard-nosed player, but I don't think he's ever been known as a dirty player. He's not a Matt Cook type, but there was the incident where he did stick his knee out, whether intentional or not, you know, we don't know, on Nicklas Hjalmarsson, and he gets cut in the head with a skate, and then there's this trash talk back and forth. I by no means would I ever claim that the Boston Bruins are saints at all. I think Brad Marchand is, you know, in a year or two will be known as one of the chippiest, rudest players in the game. He's already
putting it kindly by calling him Pippi.
Yeah, I mean, he's almost there at this point, just people don't know him yet. Zdeno Chara, the hit on Max Pacioretty, I think take us back, though, because that's something that was building for about three games.
Exactly.
You know, so why don't you, as briefly as you can, take us back, so, you know, because Zdeno Chara's claim was that he didn't do it intentionally. There, you know, the incidents that led up to it, you know, he didn't even know who it was, which in my opinion is all crap. But just
completely
take us through
there.
And lead us up to the events of the hit in Montreal that, you know, broke Pacioretty's neck.
Yeah, exactly, which that's a point that certainly should not be forgotten. But, yes, back in January, Montreal and Boston playing, and in overtime, Max Pacioretty scored the game winner. After he scored the goal, he shoved. I mean, it's certainly, when you're Max Pacioretty shoving Zdeno Chara, it certainly isn't something that is going to cause injury. He shoved Chara. All hell broke loose. Chara was on the ice. I can't recall if Lucic was on the ice. Hal Gill, PK Subban were out there. It was very, very close to completely breaking down, but it didn't, surprisingly enough. So you take a look at that, and again, it's not the type of thing that's going to cause an injury, but it obviously angered him. Then the next time they play, Chara, again, I'm not saying he's a dirty player in terms of his past, but throughout the course of that game, he was trying to get at Pacioretty. There were several instances, including a slash that sent Pacioretty off for a while, where it was clear that Chara did not appreciate the shove by Pacioretty, and he was going to go after him. Then you fast forward to the next game, and that is where everything broke loose. And like you said, I find it very hard to believe, and I'm not the only one. I'm not just a guy doing a radio show saying this. Henrik Sedin said this. There were several other players that said it as well, that for Zdeno Chara, a former Norris Trophy winner, a guy who plays close to 30 minutes a night, a guy who the main reason he's out there when he's out there is to match up against the top offensive players on the opposing team, which Max Pacioretty, since he had been called up, was one of Montreal's two or three top offensive players. I find it very, very difficult to believe that he did not know who was on the ice with him or where he was on the ice. I don't know what your take on the hit itself was. My impression is this. I certainly don't think that he He went towards Pastoretti with the intention of, I am going to break this man's neck and give him a severe concussion. I do, however, think that he went in there with every intention of driving Max Pastoretti's head into the stanchion, and that's exactly what he did. He succeeded in his goal. So for him to say what he said afterwards, I think it's a little bit disingenuous, and you could talk for a half an hour about everything that happened afterwards, but the hit itself, I'm still a little bit at a loss as to how that didn't end up garnering one of the one or two game suspensions that the league likes to throw around with great ease, seemingly.
If you just play commissioner for a second, what would you think? Even, you know, all this time has passed, and you look back on it now, what would you have given Chara?
It's tough. I would say, and I get what some people say, that you either give him 20 or you give him none. But I think that you have to, in a situation like that, you have to give a guy, in my opinion, at least 5 games. And I know people say, oh, it's because he's a Montreal Canadiens fan. It's what, you know, that's what he's going to say. But I've been on this, the whole issue of headshots and the whole issue of hits like this, and granted this was a unique one, but I've been on this regardless of the team for several years now, including this year that I've been doing my radio show. You have to get, it's an NHL buzzword, but predatory hits have to be taken out. And again, I find it real hard to believe when I see that hit, and when you see it, and some people say, oh, it's just a still, but when you see the still image of Chara with his hands up at the, you could say he didn't have his hands right on the back of the head, but up near the head of Pacioretty, driving the head into the stanchion, it's hard to say he had no intent, and it was just, I believe Bettman said it was just a hockey play gone wrong. He just rubbed him off, and he happened to hit the stanchion. That, to me, it seems a stretch, and I think that if you're not going to suspend that, then you're making it very difficult to dish out any major suspensions unless somebody's name is Matt Cook.
Yeah, I don't believe, for a second that any player, I shouldn't say any player, but I would think, 99% of the players out there, they're not intending to do serious harm to one another. But I think, and we talked about this last week, I've done a lot of questionable things, playing. But there is that moment, when you're out there and you're competing and you're caught up in the moment that you, whether it's the guy's coming at you, his head's down, he's got the puck, and you size him up and you're like, I can cream this guy right now. For that split second, sometimes good sense does escape you, and, it's just about getting even with that player for whatever you're angry with him about. And I think that that's what happened with Chara there. And, like I said, I don't think that, he's not thinking right there. And that's the problem. And I think that's the issue that's facing the league. And it's like, what do you do to get these players to stop for a second there and think? The fact that didn't even garner a suspension, I mean, the hit wasn't needed. At the very least, it's an interference penalty because the puck has gone by and – they have to battle for the puck, and Chara went out of his way to rub the guy off. I mean, that's an interference penalty. But regardless, to me, 5 games, I think that's where you need to start. It's like one of these things where you get, in the playoffs, guys don't get suspensions unless the other guy's going to be hurt and miss a game. Well, how come,
exactly.
Pacioretty's going to be gone for the rest of the year? Now, the news that's come out recently is that as of last Friday, he started skating again. But his agent came out and said that no way, he's not going to play. He's just doing light exercise, and he'll be back in for training camp. But, this guy's gone for the rest of the year, and, Char got nothing. And I think that's wrong. I think that sends the wrong message. And, I don't know. If that hit happens after the GM meetings, it doesn't make it right, but maybe he gets suspended. I don't know. But the fact that he got away with that, given the damage that was done, I think is, I don't want to use the word because, we send Montreal, people in Montreal up, it's almost criminal that he got away with it to that extent.
Well, and it's also – You mentioned the idea of if this had happened after the GM's meeting, would it have garnered a suspension? And even that, I think, is questionable because we saw the Cook hit, which the league reacted very harshly to. And believe me, I'm all for it. I'm glad that they suspended him for that length. But then we've seen several headshots since then, and they're all going back to, you know, to the couple game suspension. The hit on Marcus Kruger, for example, which, you know, granted it wasn't. You could argue it wasn't to the level of some of the other hits, but again, I think that that's where the league gets themselves in a bind. The whole idea that we're going to try to figure out the degree of a headshot, we're going to try to get into guys' heads and determine intent. There's the whole argument of, well, is the guy a repeat offender, and that plays into it. And my whole thought, at least the way I see the logic, is that how can you ever be a repeat offender if you're not going to be suspended on your first offense because you haven't done it before? It seems to be a flawed system to me, and it seems, well, yes, if you have a blanket rule, okay, you're going to have some hits that are borderline that maybe weren't as bad as another hit, and they're all going to be penalized the same way. But if the goal is to actually get the hits out of the game and not just have suspensions for semantics' sake, then you're going to have to have a few things that are maybe borderline and maybe not that bad, get caught up in the undertow. So like you said, get in the guys' heads and make them think in that split second that I better not do this because I'm going to be putting myself in a bad position, I'm going to be putting my team in a bad position, and it may cost us even into the playoffs. So it's tough, and I think the league makes it tougher on themselves than it needs to be.
Well, you know what, and this is going to cause a whole big discussion, but I'll just say this, and I'll give you a chance to respond. We'll move on. But because I was talking about this with someone last night. We were talking about, you know, things like this, hits and supplementary discipline. And the problem that the NHL has is they have an identity crisis, that they want violence in the game because that's what people want. You know, it's why when I say that, you know, the Blackhawks bench, you know, allegedly taunting Sean Thornton as he gets a skate blade across the brow of his eye, you know, a quarter of an inch, you know, in the wrong direction, and he loses his eyeball, you know, and the Blackhawks fans will say, oh, that's fine, you know, he deserved it because he needed to need Jalmerson. Well, the NHL knows that violence is a part of the, you know, the allure of the game. And some fans, that's what they want. I mean, that's why there's going to be such a resistance to taking fighting out of the game, to removing all hits from the game. So the league doesn't want to take violence out of the game. They want to take the perception of violent acts out of the game. And that's why Yanni Haida gets 2 games for an elbow. Kubina gets 2 games for an elbow, because when you look at that, it's like, well, how can the league defend that? Whereas when you go to the Chara incident, you know, they fell all over themselves to say, well, that it's the stanchion. It's the stanchion. Basically blaming the Montreal or the Bell Center for having a stanchion there. I mean, no. I mean, the player knows it's there. You know,
well, the stanchion's been there for how long, and how many times does this actually happen? That's the other argument to me. If this was happening every week or every month in the Bell Center, well, then you could, you know, by now something would have changed in terms of the layout of the rink. But to blame the stanchion solely is like some people have, is pretty ridiculous.
All right, we got a few things here to we want to get with you before we let you go, so we'll kind of run through them. Carey Hart, you know, at one time a lot of people pumping him for the Hart and the Vezina. At this stage of the season, do you put him in that conversation for either award?
I think, and this is going to sound weird, because I think probably not for the Vezina, only because the last couple of weeks, in terms of the amount of goals he's been let in and the number of times he's been pulled, which hasn't really been his fault with how poorly the defense has played, but it's the perception and it's numbers, and it's hard to go with anybody other than Tim Thomas. I don't think he has a legitimate claim to the Hart in terms of how the award is given out. But if you look at what a most valuable player is supposed to be, there aren't too many players that are more valuable to their team than Carey Price and have performed at that level. So in a perfect world, I think he'd be one of the top three, but I don't think he's going to be in that group.
Who else would you put in that group for, you know, your top three for the Vezina?
Well, Tim Thomas, like I said, and I think, is the guy that always goes under the radar, but it's hard to ignore him, is Ilya Brizgalov. That's another guy who you wonder where the team would be without him. And then I think there's No, there's a group of guys. You could throw Carey Price into that mix. It's hard to argue with Henrik Lundqvist not being in that group, but in the end, I think it's Tim Thomas and then who the two runners up are. I don't know that. I would be shocked if anybody other than Tim Thomas came anywhere close to winning the award.
Probably the most interesting award this year is the Hart, just because, you know, you got in Vancouver, you got the Sedin twins, who could very well take votes away from each other.
Yeah.
And, you know, so, I mean, do you see there being a front runner at this point, or do you think one of, you know, is it Daniel Sedin's year?
I think there's a lot of momentum to that, but I think the point about them possibly splitting votes is pretty valid. I mean, part of the problem, too, is you had Sidney Crosby, which seemed to be the runaway candidate early first part of the year, and obviously with the long-term injury with him, that's not going to happen. Steve Stamkos, strictly from a goal-scoring standpoint, seemed like he was ready to step into that slot. He's gone cold the last couple months, you could say. The guy that would be my pick would actually be Corey Perry, just when you look at what he's done at the most important part of the season and where the team would be without what he's, or, you know, without what he's done. And granted, Teemu Selanne has been a big part of a lot of these come-from-behind wins they've had, but it's hard to argue with what Corey Perry's done. It's certainly, again, when you go into the ideal, what I wish the Hart Trophy would be about, sort of melding statistics with really how much a guy matters to his team, you would think that Jonathan Toews would be in the argument. He certainly hasn't had the numbers the last couple of weeks, but the combination of what he means to his team and still some pretty darn good numbers, you would think would have him in the mix, but I kind of think that's not going to happen now.
Yeah, I think a guy, too, that's going to get some votes, and I wouldn't personally vote for him, because even though as much as he's meant to the Pittsburgh Penguins, it would be like giving a guy a second half award, but Marc-Andre Fleury. You know,
yeah.
I mean, with
so that's
Crosby
why
out,
I don't have him to Vezina. That's why I don't have him to Vezina as well, because that first third of the season, at least the first quarter of the season, he was awful. There was serious talk about had he lost the starting job, at least for this year, to Brent Johnson, who was very good at the beginning of the year. So it's hard, much in the same way that, and even though Lou Lamoriello wasn't there for the first part of the season, it's the same kind of the same argument as to why it's hard to give him the Jack Adams Award as well.
Let's talk about MVP. You know, your Blackhawks MVP, is there a front runner in your opinion?
The easy pick is Toews, and I think you certainly could not go wrong with that. But I wonder what we would be talking about right now, or where we would be in terms of following the Hawks season if Corey Crawford didn't exist. It's been amazing what he's done, and not shocking in the sense that, as has been talked about ad nauseum, it wasn't as though the reason he didn't get the job last year to start the year as a backup with the Blackhawks was purely because of on-ice play. There were other contractual factors at work, but what Corey Crawford's done has been amazing, and I hope that he's starting to at least get into the Calder conversation. I know some people are talking about him on the outskirts of it, but to me, he belongs in the top three, if not actually winning the award.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I think, the age thing is going to, you know, if Jeff Skinner wasn't a pure 18-year-old, I think that Crawford would have a better shot. But, you know, that age thing does come into play in most people's minds. I don't necessarily agree with it, but it's going to be a factor in the voting, and it's going to be tough for him to win, although we'll talk more about that later. Blackhawks, will they get in? And if they get in, do they win a round, in your opinion?
I'll say this. I actually think that they're better off finishing in seventh or eighth and playing Vancouver or Detroit than if they somehow ended up in the middle. I mean, who knows how the seedings are going to play out, but I would not want to see them play in Nashville. I wouldn't be overjoyed to see them play Dallas or Phoenix. So I think if they play Vancouver, it's obviously going to be very tough. If they get Detroit in the first round, I would not at all be surprised if they knock Detroit off. When you look at the fact that they, in a lot of ways, they're basically mirror image teams, and the Hawks seem to play a much better game against those style of teams than either the big physical teams or, like we saw Sunday night, the very difficult defensive structure of a team like Tampa Bay.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely something to that of the Blackhawks, especially, you know, a team that they would get up to play for, you know. You know, a Detroit or a Vancouver. Although I think Vancouver's just, that's, in my opinion, if it's Vancouver, you know, I was talking to somebody about this last night, if it's Vancouver, the last place the Blackhawks want to see them is the first round when they're focused and you know the chip that they have on their shoulder right now about the Blackhawks. You know, you'd almost want them to be, you know, go through a scare or maybe get too big on themselves and, you know, lose that focus of how they've gotten knocked out from the Blackhawks before. Because, you know it's all about discipline with them, and I think that they'd be more focused on containing that emotion in the first round as compared to any other round. But there is something to be said about the Blackhawks playing up and down to their level of competition.
Well, let me ask you a question real quick. As far as playoff seedings, what do you think would happen if the Vancouver Canucks played the Anaheim Ducks in the first round? Because I think if I'm Vancouver, that is the team that I am not looking forward to playing in the first round.
I know, and that could happen. You know, Anaheim's got a rough – they only have 3 games left, and it's a rough schedule. They got San Jose at home on Wednesday night, and then they got a home-and-home with L.A. Friday and Saturday. That very well could happen. I like Anaheim a lot just because they're just so difficult to play against. Any team that they play, you know, especially in a series, you know, unless you get up on Anaheim 2-0, it's going to be, you know, even if you do, they're going to wear you out as the series goes along. That's Vancouver. You're right. I mean, if I was Vancouver, that's the only team really that scares me at this point. I mean, maybe I guess you put San Jose in there, but especially for the first round.
And the only thing I think with Anaheim that could, and granted, they're obviously they're going to be a lower seed, but the only thing that I think would lead to a very quick exit, you know, getting swept or getting knocked out in 5 games, is if for some reason Ray Emery doesn't hold up. I mean, he's been an incredible story, and like Randy Carlyle said, he's basically been a godsend. I mean, they have Dan Ellis waiting in the wings if necessary, and who knows when Jonas Hiller is going to be back, but. Without Ray Emery, I think they're hanging out somewhere down with, maybe not down with Minnesota, but they're in a similar boat to Calgary right now without him.
All right, before we let you go, I know that we didn't get to this last time, but Adam, you're a guy that you know, makes the trek out to Rockford at times this year and has probably seen the Rockford IceHogs been beaten down on many occasions. you know, as have I, being out there. You know, I mean, talk a bit about your experiences going out and seeing the IceHogs and your impressions of what would hopefully be the next crop of players filling out the Blackhawks roster.
Yeah, I get out there. I think I've, this coming Saturday, the final game of the year, that'll be my 8th game that I've been to this year. So it's hard to I never like to make blanket statements when I've seen, you know, a relatively small sample size of the team's play, but particularly early in the year, I don't know what your thoughts are on Bill Peters as a coach. I don't know that that necessarily was the problem. I just think you have so many guys on the team that are, you know, in their first year as pros and coming from various different leagues, whether it be from any of the three Canadian junior leagues, whether it be coming from collegiate hockey, that it just seemed it seemed as though maybe it was a mistake and that they didn't have particularly up front. Other than Tave and Patolny, you really didn't have any sort of veteran leadership, and I think that played a role partially in what was going on. But it seems to me, and again, it's a small sample size, it seems to me that they've played better the last month or so. Granted, there have still been a couple of blowouts. The blowout last week, a game I was at, I believe it was March 18th, against Oklahoma City, where they played great in the first period, and then it was just a parade to the penalty box in the second, and Toivonen gave up, I believe, 5 in that period, and that was pretty much the game. So very inconsistent season as far as players that I've been impressed by. And, again, all these guys are works in progress, so it's hard to say that a guy looks great every game. But Dylan Olsen, who, granted, there are times when – particularly when the play gets really scrambly in his own zone, where it seems as though he kind of loses his place and has trouble figuring out, you know, who his guy is supposed to be, where he's supposed to go. But the things that you would expect him at this early age to do well, he seems to do very well, particularly along the boards. And they seem to be pretty smart in how they're handling him, in that every game that I've been to, he's either been playing with Exelby or Cullimore, which both are large defensemen like him, who I'm sure they hope that his career ends up going to greater heights than either of theirs did. But they're guys that I'm sure the Hawks think he can learn something from. So Dylan Olsen, he's certainly not close. He's probably a couple years away, but interesting to see him. The guy who I haven't had a chance to see live yet, but I'm very excited to get a chance to see him this Saturday. Hopefully he'll be in the lineup. It's Jimmy Hayes from Boston College. I was very impressed with him at the Blackhawks prospect camp last summer, and he's a big forward with a lot of size, which Kyle Beach aside, they don't have a lot of guys in the pipeline in that power forward role. So really looking forward to seeing him as well.
Yeah, they got a couple of guys that, you know, David Gilbert, although he's not a, you know, he's not a physical player. He just joined the team on an amateur tryout. One would think he'd get a Blackhawks contract next year. He's been penciled in for Rockford all year long for next year's team. And also Philip Paradis, who's a winger who's very much in their plans. Two-way forward. He's been in a bit of suspension trouble this year with his junior team. He's turning pro next year. He actually is going to be in the lineup tomorrow night when the Ice Hawks are in San Antonio. So, yeah, I look for those two this weekend. And, of course, Jimmy Hayes. You know, Bill Peters' plan, anyway, is to have Jimmy Hayes in the lineup for all seven of these remaining games since he joined the team. So, yeah, it was, you know, getting back to Hannu Toivonen, you know, it was interesting when I looked it up a couple of days ago. Hannu Toivonen has been pulled from 20% of his starts this year.
It doesn't surprise me. He's feast or famine. He's either great. I mean, I've listened to games. I've been at games where, I mean, he looks like an NHL-caliber goalie. And then there's other games where if he's off, he's off by a mile.
Yeah, very much so. I want to wrap here with you, let you get going. But as a member, we'll plug everything that you do, Adam. There as a member of the F4W Online Empire over there at WrestlingObserver.com. In the news recently, of course, WrestleMania on Sunday. I didn't see it. I heard it was horrible.
Entertainment.
Yeah. Well, that's what I want to talk about. The Rock promised the greatest WrestleMania moment in history, and he lied. Imagine that.
It was a double countout. That's shocking. Come on.
A double countout main event. But Vince McMahon, who we know very well, is, you know, he's been in a 20-year-long midlife crisis now. And, you know, he's a man that's trying to procure his legacy, and he has this this image issue in that everybody sees him as a wrestling promoter and only a wrestling promoter. So he's banned words that were, you know, that are considered wrestling terms, wrestler being
such
one.
As the word wrestling, for
yeah.
example.
And I don't think many people listening to this probably don't know the story, but WWF became WWE because Vince was stubborn and ignored a lawsuit with the World Wildlife Fund, and it became WWE, and that was kind of a thing at the time. But this very week, during meetings in Atlanta, WrestleMania week, Vince basically decided that they're going to drop wrestling from the letters World Wrestling Entertainment. And no more wrestling, wrestlers, anything. They're entertainers and they're sports entertainment, and that's it. I don't know what he's going to do, though, because Vince has got a problem on his hands, because his biggest event just this past Sunday, his marquee moneymaker, the entire foundation that his fortune is built on, is WrestleMania. What are your thoughts about there being no more wrestling, according to Vince McMahon?
Well, really, I think it's, I mean, in the end, I think it's just kind of the final polishing off of the remnants of the non-WWE business, at least on a grand scale. I mean, it's like you said, this has been a long time coming. There's something to, I mean, it's an incredible psychological case study in that you've got a guy who's made his entire fortune off of being a pro wrestling promoter and being as pro wrestling of a pro wrestling promoter as there could be in some ways, as far as how much of a carny he is, yet he is deathly afraid of anybody thinking he's a professional wrestling promoter. There was the story last week, the newspaper reporter was talking about the Hall of Fame ceremony, and he referred to it as, in the articles, a pro wrestling Hall of Fame. And he got a very quick, angry call from a WWE PR person who demanded that he took the word wrestling out of it. And like you said, he said that And the PR person said that they don't do professional wrestling events. They do entertainments. So in the end, I think he's going to be frustrated till the day he dies, because no matter how much he wants to call it sports entertainment, everybody still calls it pro wrestling. I mean, there's no wrestler calls themselves a sports entertainer other than when they're on the camera. They're going to call themselves a professional wrestler. So I don't see him giving up this crusade. I would be shocked if in 5 years it's not just called Mania, or it's not just WWE Mania. And I think, to me, it's short-sighted, because everybody knows what it is. It's pro wrestling. But when you constantly demean a longtime fans, particularly the large segment of professional wrestling fans that they lost when WCW died, like, they did absolutely nothing to endear themselves to, you know, to those people who grew up on Mid-South, or who grew up on NWA and later WCW, people like me, for example. And I think a lot of people, it's a long conversation that we won't have right now, but I think a lot of people gave up, and a lot of people went and watched MMA instead. And I think that you're not going to get those people back, and he's certainly not doing anything to bring those people back.
I feel bad for him in a way, though, because, you know, he really does, to be, you know, the impact that wrestling, the Vince McMahon-driven wrestling model has had on pop culture and in the mainstream, I don't think anybody really, too many people really realize how influential he has been. And it's not all of him. He took from a lot of different places, and, you know, he didn't reinvent wrestling. He just put it on the national stage, but he deserves all the credit for that. And, you know, maybe he does deserve more credit than just being remembered as a wrestling promoter. But, as far as running people off, though, and again, you know, I don't want to get into it, but I don't really blame him. I mean, there's no other competition. It's like, you know, when you and I, you're a few years younger than I am, but I'm 33, but, you know, when I grew up in the mid-80s, when I was, you know, 7, 8 years old, I wasn't into saying your prayers and eating your vitamins. I wasn't into that crap. You know, I was into fast cars, limos, Lear jets, and, you know, women who could fill out a sweater, you know. So, you know, I was watching the NWA and Ric Flair and the Horsemen, and, you know, the WWE, because there is no real competition, because TNA's, you know, just a place for washout junkies, you know, he's trying to, you know, to play to all these different audiences. And anything that you do, whenever you're trying to please everybody, it's just not going to work. And I worry about the industry as a whole, where it's going to be, because, you know, they don't make new stars. TNA is worthless. And, you know, there is no TV for anybody else. So it's going to be a tough ride. And I worry, too, about MMA. I mean, there's just too much MMA. You can't even keep up. You know, it's just something every week, and it's too much. But, Adam, I want to thank you very much for joining us. We'll have you back again during the playoffs to maybe second, third round, to get your take on what's going on. But, again, that's Adam Summers, at Adam_Summers on Twitter. And also at the Breakout Hockey program at breakouthockey.automatic.com. We'll put the links up, and also the F4W online. Thank you very much, Adam, for joining us, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Definitely. Thank you guys very much for having me. And just a quick note, I should have a show up tomorrow, not too long after the Blackhawks-Habs matchup. So if you want to check that out, please do. And thanks guys again. Hopefully I'll talk to you soon.
All right. Thanks a lot, Adam. Superstar.
Another awesome interview done by a superstar.
I had to turn you down there because you were making a lot of noise again.
That's so funny because I don't do anything. I sit here.
I know. I think your mic is too loud. I think that's the problem. And it might be the switchboard. I have literally nothing up but the call bank on the switchboard. I don't see anything right now. I have plenty of audio files, and there are but a three up there right now. So I don't know what the deal is, but let's continue on. We got about 35 minutes left in the live stream. Superstar. an ugly weekend for the Blackhawks. You know, a game on Friday night in Columbus that they just couldn't. I mean, they tried and they tried and they tried to give that game away. Columbus just isn't good enough to take it. And they needed a shootout to do it, but they get the 2 points there. They come back on Sunday night here in Chicago, Tampa Bay Lightning. And, you know, I mean, I think that the shot differential in that game, you know, the Blackhawks doubling up basically 31-15, I don't think that tells the entire story just because, again, you know, this is the problem all along with the Blackhawks. You talked about it earlier when we talk about the Canadians. They actually do have guys that go to the net and cause trouble, and they have defensemen that stand there and wait and try to use players as screens, and, you know, whether it be from the top of the point. Too much of the Blackhawks' offense comes from the outside. And, you know, what are your thoughts, you know, on the weekend, the Blackhawks? They get 2 out of 4 points, but just when you're looking for positive signs, they're just not there right now.
No, they're not. I couldn't agree with you more. You obviously needed the game in Columbus. You needed the two at this point of the year with Columbus not being in it. You're not really worried about that third point. But it was imperative that you got two. And you mentioned the outside scoring. I mean, the goal that I can't think of the third goal. You know, the weak little wrist shot was from 40 feet. Bickles. That's not going to happen in the playoffs. You know, you're not going to have goals like that scored in the playoffs. It's you score your goals in the playoffs and by going to the net, throwing pucks in next, getting rebounds, playing ugly. That's how you win in the playoffs. And they're just not doing that at all. And you figure a team in a position that they're in is in playoff mode. I mean, let's face it. They've been in playoff mode for 4 or 5 weeks, if not longer. And, there's a win's a win, but there wasn't a lot you could take out of that that win and say, okay, we can build off of this.
Yeah, you know what? I think from this point forward, and let's talk about what's going on here in the standings. And let me see if I can go real quick to see what the heck is going on tonight in the NHL. It's an Eastern Conference game.
There's not a lot going on, man.
No, I know. It's an Eastern Conference game. But tonight, L.A. is in San Jose. That game's just about to start, as it's 8:57 here right now as we do this live. So that game has an impact on the standings, of course. L.A. without Kopitar, without Justin Williams for the time being, it appears as though he might make a miraculous comeback to help the L.A. Kings. But, you know, the Blackhawks right now sit in a heck of a spot. You know, they've got 4 games left and 92 points. And, you know, again, basically all the Blackhawks have to do is win a game and they eliminate Calgary. So they're, you know, because Calgary only has 2 games left. The most points that Calgary can end up with are 95. Calgary has left, I'm not exactly sure. Why don't we start with Phoenix? Let's start with everything I have written out in front of me, which excludes the Calgary. Well, no, here we go. Okay. So Calgary on both, they have 2 home games, the first being against Edmonton. So if the Blackhawks absolutely need to win it's going to be tough to go into Bell Center and win, but I think at the very least they need a point, because the last thing you want is to go into the Joe or, you know, the final game at home on Sunday morning, 11:30 start Chicago time. And, you know, go into that game needing to win to get into the playoffs. Because, you know, no matter where the Red Wings are, the Red Wings will show up to eliminate you if they have the chance. I don't think that they'll rest their people. I think they'll look at that game as an opportunity to beat or eliminate one of the teams that could beat them in the postseason. And if the Blackhawks could get healthy and motivated and start playing the right way, they very well could knock off the Red Wings. You know, crazier things have happened. I mean, I'm not buying it at this stage, just because you look at their body of work over the course of the season. I don't know, you know, don't give me fool's gold. You know, I think that the Blackhawks at this stage are what they are. They're exactly what we saw this past weekend. Yeah, if you throw Sharp into there, you know, they're a little bit better. But, you know, Sharp wasn't exactly lighting the world on fire before he got injured either. So do you put him back in the lineup and that adds a goal per game? I don't think you can count on that. And even if it does, it doesn't win you some of the, it doesn't win you some of these games that, you know, these close games that they're losing. So I don't know. I think that at this stage, you know, they really needed to win that game against Tampa, because the focus at this stage isn't all, it almost isn't about winning. You would think that the Blackhawks would win two of these last four. It's not going to be easy. They put themselves in this spot now where they're playing must-win games in the last week of the season, which was the place they absolutely didn't want to be. They can say whatever they want about these games as they come up, you know, and that, well, we're going to have to play playoff hockey. Well, you've had to play playoff hockey for, you know, 2 months now, and you've been, you know, in and out of that consciousness. You know, what they need to focus on is doing things the right way, and I think if they play the right way, you know, like my big thing about them in Boston the other night, I'm not giving them a break because it's the back end of a home and home or a back end of a back-to-back. They've done well in back end of back-to-backs all year long. They're professional athletes, you know, and they charter to Boston. They get the morning off. All they have to do is step on the ice and play a game. They don't take a penalty all game, so they're never shorthanded. That's not a difficult game to compete in. And what do? They chase the puck around, but they didn't compete for it. And they know it. They said as much after the game. And they did the same thing. You know, they had a lot of energy in Columbus. They just exercised it poorly. You know, going forward to the Tampa game, it's sort of the same thing. They're chasing the puck around, but they're not really working for their chances. You know, Tampa sat back, and the Blackhawks had the puck the most of the time, but they weren't working for their chances. And I think you start there. To me, though, I get your opinion of this. The Blackhawks' defense, to me, I wonder. I've been thinking about this. I'm wondering what they're exactly good at right now when they don't have the puck. You know, because they don't really – they're overmatched in their own zone, and they're often caught out of position, from their decisions pinching. And all, it's the defense, which is supposed to be the Blackhawks' strength, is actually at this point, in my opinion, playing probably the worst hockey we've seen in 2 or 3 years. Brent Seabrook against Anaheim was awful. The defense against Columbus was really no good. You know, they really had the opportunity to be bad. Of course, you know, Keith and Seabrook just allowing LeCavalier to stand there for the power play goal on Sunday night. But, I mean, what do you think about this Blackhawk defense right now? Is it, you know, Nick Leddy doesn't play again. We talked about it all year long. If he was as good as everybody, you know, everybody thought he was, looking at him through rose-colored glasses, I mean, he'd be playing right now, and he's not. So he didn't belong here all along, just as I said. You know, great for the future, but if he had this audition and he's been playing all this time, why can't he play when games matter? The answer to that question, clearly, is he doesn't belong, and he should have been in Rockford the whole time, and the GM failed. But, I mean, what do you think about this defense right now and the way that they're playing?
You know, and you go back and it started early with the Duncan Keith and you know, saying as the year went on that he's probably trying to do a little too much offensively, you know, pinching and just overall, you know, trying to make every play and be the Superman out there every time he steps on the ice instead of, you know, taking the same play, doing, you know, we talked about it a couple weeks ago, concentrating on what he is, and that is a defenseman playing defense. And you brought something up, what are they good at right now? And you hit it on that. They're very good at getting out of position and then scrambling and you know, getting themselves back somewhat into position. It's really the only thing they're good at. They're really good at that, and then they're really good at making unbelievable defensive plays after the defenseman gives up the puck in the own zone. Yeah,
you know, well, that's how Duncan Keith made his name, was chase after a mistake, chasing back, using his speed to get back and cover up for it. That's how Duncan Keith became a Norris Trophy winner. You know,
covering up his own mistake.
This year it hasn't worked out so well. You know, I love Duncan Keith. Don't get me wrong. You know, we went over this all last year long. I love him, you know, as a player, and he's very, very good. But, you know, all the things that we brought up last year are I mean, that's the problems this year. You know, and he's right. He tried to be too offensive early on. He's dialed that back, and he's been better. But, you know, I think this year's Duncan Keith is the Duncan Keith you can look forward to. And that, when you look at that contract, that's going to be a problem. I think tomorrow, I think Tuesday night in Montreal, the thing to look for, Montreal's, it's, you know, they're going to play an up-tempo game. You know, unless they get a 2-0 lead at some point, you'll see them do the same thing that Tampa Bay does or did. They'll sit back and wait for the Blackhawks to make mistakes and then try to use their speed. I think from the defensive standpoint, I think the Blackhawks have to dial back in the neutral zone and allow the Canadians to come to them and, you know, not try to make these plays in the neutral zone at the top of the point in the offensive zone, because, you know, that's when bouncing pucks get behind the Blackhawks, and Montreal will create odd man situations in those cases. And if that's the kind of game the Blackhawks are going to play, where they're constantly in transition all game, if the game is close at the end, they don't stand a chance, because they will be too taxed. Because, we see it. You know, all year long, you know, you have players on this team. I said before the season started that Pisani would be gone by December. I was wrong, but when, you know, Pisani was okay to a certain point. When was that point? It was about mid-December, late December. Yeah. And since, you know, what has he done? I mean, he's had some injury issues, but now he's playing 5 minutes a night. Why is he playing 5 minutes a night? Because you can't – I mean, with Boland out, the one good thing about Boland is he covers for everybody else on his line. That's the kind of center that he is. So you can't hide anybody, you know, on a line with Jake Dowell or even on a line with Ryan Johnson. Maybe you could stick one guy on there, but you can't hide two. And that's why guys like Pisani are not skating much. Jake Dowell, not skating much, because you just can't – there's only so many players that you can hide. And, you know, that's the problem.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead. We got to rifle through these things.
All right, you know, real quick, you brought something up that I, you know, wanted to see if you had an update or if you heard anything. Just overall on the injury front, Dave Boland, Patrick Sharp, when those guys, if those guys are looking to return.
Well, I mean, I think it's rather apparent now that Patrick Sharp will be back this week, just because they're going to need him. You know, I don't know that they rush him back for Wednesday against St. Louis. I mean, can you imagine, superstar, if they lose in Montreal tomorrow night? You know, Dallas has, let's go back since I have everything in front of me now. Dallas, 4 games left, and they couldn't be 4 easier games for them. Now, Dallas isn't the greatest team. I think they're a dangerous team for anybody that, if they do get in the playoffs, anybody that they play, I think that they do present some issues for. But Dallas plays Tuesday night. They're at home against Columbus. You would think that a team fighting for their playoff lives, playing the Columbus Blue Jackets, that the Dallas Stars at home would win that game. Thursday night, they get Colorado coming in. Colorado's been atrocious, okay? That's, you would pencil that game in for Dallas as a victory, okay? So, at that stage, Dallas right now has 89 points. So, if they win those 2 games, they then have 93. Okay, that's on Thursday night. They'd have 93 points. Currently, the Blackhawks have 92. So, if they lose in Montreal and don't get a point, how enormous is this game in St. Louis or at the United Center with St. Louis with a team that's going to come in? St. Louis on a roll lately, scoring goals like, you know, I mean, they could score all year long, and now they're putting up 10 in 6 spots. They're coming in here. They hate the Blackhawks. They love nothing better to make the Blackhawks' weekend against the Detroit Red Wings even more miserable than it probably could be. You know, I mean, how enormous would Wednesday night's game be?
It's amazing that we're even considering the fact that
yeah, that game has any meaning whatsoever. But,
so then Friday night then Dallas would go for their third of these four games, then go to Colorado. You know, again, I mean, I don't know that you can ever pencil wins in for anybody really at any point in the season in this NHL anymore, but you would think that they'd at least get a point there, probably win that hockey game. And then it would all come down to Sunday, because at that point, let's say they get a point, then that puts them at 94. They win that game, that puts them at 95. The Blackhawks need at least two victories, at least two out of these four, to be in a position, if Dallas wins three of their last four, to finish ahead of the Dallas Stars. You know, and then their final game of the season, which is no gimme for Dallas, especially because it's in Minnesota on Sunday. That, I don't think, you throw the record book out there, that's a complete toss-up. But the Blackhawks have to win two of these four to get in. And it's incredible at this stage of the season that we're even talking about this, but it's the fact of the matter. Dallas has got a schedule that you would figure they're going to take at least three of those four. So the Blackhawks, there's no, you know, they need 4 points, I guess you could say. But at some point, you got to start winning hockey games. Otherwise, you know, you're going to get throat and gut punched in the playoffs. I know people are talking about Anaheim. Well, what if Anaheim falls out? What if Nashville falls out? Well, Nashville's scheduled Tuesday night. They're at home to Atlanta. Friday night, Nashville has Columbus coming to town, and then they finish up the season on Saturday in St. Louis. Not a tough schedule. Don't look for Nashville to fall out. You know, and then the rest of the schedule is pretty interesting, because the other three teams kind of play each other. Phoenix finishes at L.A., San Jose, and then at San Jose. And then, of course, the Kings are at San Jose, Phoenix at home, and then they finish up Friday and Saturday with a home-and-home with Anaheim. And then, of course, Anaheim's got San Jose, L.A., then at the Kings. So you would figure that those three teams are just sort of kind of beat up on each other, and they'll all accumulate points in some form or fashion. So, no, I mean, the way it looks to me, anyhow, is this comes down to Chicago and Dallas. And maybe the seeding moves around a little bit, but as far as who gets that eighth spot, just looking at it, you know, and kind of theorize, I mean, it's Dallas or Chicago. And the Hawks have to win at least two, and maybe even three. And if we're talking about these Blackhawks winning three of their last four, you know, I've been saying all year long that there's no way. Even up until last week on the show, I said, no way, don't worry about it. And here we are. I don't know that they can win three of their last four. I really don't.
I wouldn't put any money on it, that's for sure. You know, it'd be different if they had put up consistent efforts the last 2 weeks, where you say, all right, you know, the effort's there, they're just a little snake bitten right now, or you know, the brakes aren't going your way right now. That'd be a different story. But the fact that we've gotten half-ass efforts, you know, multiple times over the last 2-3 weeks, you know, now you know it's a lot harder, you know, step on the gas than it is to take your foot off the pedal, so to speak.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see. Next week, we will probably do a show at some point next week. But I know Monday night I'm going to be on the Hockey Night Puckcast. So as far as the Third Man in Radio, professional podcasting right here. We'll probably do something probably after game one. I'm going to call it right now, Superstar. After game one of the Blackhawks' first round matchup, we're going to do a podcast.
What are you going on a limb there?
You can send your hate mail to Chris Block at thethirdmanin.com. Oh, before we have some announcements to make, Superstar.
Really?
Yeah. You know, it's funny because I have basically in two of my leagues that just wrapped up, I have basically the identical rosters. In one league this past week, I won the championship. And in the other league with virtually the same roster, I got creamed in the third place game 13-3 or something along those lines. So I think the moral
that's
of that story is, I think the moral of that story is don't play more than one league. But yeah, I was lucky enough to win one of my leagues. The other one, I got robbed in the first round. It was real crap, but we do have to one of our third man in fantasy leagues wrapped up this week, and another one doesn't wrap up till next week. But we do have to announce and congratulate in the second annual third man in fantasy hockey league. We have a back to back winner. The Crease Monkeys took the championship this week in extravagant fashion, 12-4. Over the Sussex Stars. So congratulations to Lane. He is, once again, your third man in Fantasy Hockey League winner. How'd you do in that thing, Superstar?
I don't know. Dude, Lane's probably waiting for his prize for winning the first year, let alone the second year.
Yeah, I believe I announced the prize as two tickets to a 2011-12 Blackhawks game of their choice outside of opening night, which I can't promise. Although I may have a wedding that night, so that it may be negotiable. Actually, no, I wouldn't be, unless it falls on a Sunday night. I just found that out the other day. I was at a wedding on Saturday night, Superstar.
How'd it go?
It was nice. I can tell you right now, Superstar, you lost to the eventual champion 11-5 in the quarterfinals back on March 20th. So.
Well, you know, if we was in a really bad league, if I made the quarterfinals, I don't think I logged into Yahoo Fantasy Hockey for 2 months. So the fact that I made the quarterfinals anyways is pretty bad.
That's just great. So the Crease Monkeys first, that's Lane. Walter, Sussex Stars, finished in second. Walter, I believe, was a first-timer, pretty sure. And then in third, Eric's off the post. He defeated me in the third-place game. So congratulations to all, and hopefully we'll see you guys next year and maybe we'll even try that third man in fantasy draft party again.
It couldn't go any worse.
No. All right. You got your picks in front of you. We're gonna finish up here with the our 2010 NHL awards.
Let's do it.
All right. Why don't we start with the Blackhawks? Who is your Blackhawks MVP?
You know, as we were talking about earlier, it's obviously, Jonathan Toews is going to be a pretty popular choice, and I don't think you'd be wrong in that. But I think I'm going to go the other way and go with Corey Crawford. I don't even want to think about where this team would be without him, you know, coming up huge on multiple occasions. In my mind, while Toews is obviously an extremely valuable, you know, piece of the wheel, it's Corey Crawford.
Yeah, you know, I agree with that wholeheartedly. You know, I wrote, you know, when Toews got hot all that little time ago, and, you know, to me, he just seems like at this stage, like everything that he could, all the energy that he could muster to carry the team during that streak that they went on, he expended it, because it's not like he's not trying. I wouldn't accuse Jonathan Toews of not trying, because I watched the games, and I don't believe that to be the case. He just looks like a guy that's completely out of gas. Oh, that reminds me. Friday night, Columbus. Let's go back to the point, I believe, in the second period. People watch the game and actually do watch the game and don't chat online the whole time or on their Twitter. you'll remember the play where there's a whistle in front of Matthew Garon, and Taves ends up getting double teamed by obviously two Blue Jackets. And Brian Bickell, whoever he paired off with, the guy just threw Brian Bickell on the ground immediately and pinned him there. He was completely defenseless. Go figure. But if you watch the replay, you know, and there was a big thing about that from Pat Foley and Eddie Olczyk at the time, because they were questioning whether or not or why the defenseman didn't come down. And, of course, if the defenseman comes down, the Blackhawks lose the draw in the offensive zone. But the point is, your captain is getting mauled in front of the net by two guys, and since Brian Bickell's of no use whatsoever, you know, why doesn't one of the defensemen come down and help out Jonathan Toews? Well, I mean, I believe it was Brian Campbell and Chris Campoli, but it's not about going down there and roughing anybody up. It's just about going down there and taking a guy to allow the linesmen to get in there and do their job more effectively. That's really the point of the matter. It's not, oh, you got to go down there and get involved physically per se. You're just to step in, take a guy, and allow the linesmen and the referees to do their job. Well, if you watch the replay, and, you know, we don't have time to do this, but it was interesting a couple of weeks ago when Victor Stahlberg was interviewed after one of the nights that he had a good game, and they interviewed him, and he talked about how earlier in the season when Stahlberg was playing with Toews and Kane, you know, he expressed how hard that they were, how critical they were of Stahlberg. And I'm not going to defend Victor Stahlberg. I'm critical of him too. But Stahlberg's thing was, and he expressed that he felt, you know, or at the time he didn't know how to respond to it because they were so critical of him that he let it affect him personally and his confidence on the ice, that they ragged on him that much, according to what Stahlberg said, that it affected him, you know, his psyche. To whereas now that, you know, when they do it, I guess he probably wouldn't say this, but he's just more used to it now, and he knows that that's, I think he even said, he just knows that that's how they are. It's an interesting quote, and I think it'd be an interesting discussion. It's like, you know, these two guys are, I mean, they're obviously fantastic players. Patrick Kane is a brilliant player. Jonathan Toews, terrific player. But it's an interesting thing that, you know, these guys think already at this stage, you know, 22 years old, that, I mean, they're all that. You know, they know everything. And I'm not going to say that Victor Stahlberg deserves any respect from anybody. But it was interesting to hear that. In Columbus, during that play, when you watch the replay, when the whistle blows, on the replay you got to see it. When the whistle blows, Patrick Kane doesn't even, you know, he's so upset that the play didn't go his way. I think he shot the puck and Bickell didn't get the rebound. The whistle blows. Patrick Kane in a huff, and if you remember in the first period of that game, Patrick Kane's yelling at Marian Hossa because he didn't get the puck where Patrick Kane wanted it to, and he explained it during the intermission. He was right, but he's screaming at Marian Hossa in a way that everybody can see. Patrick Kane, the whistle blows. Patrick Kane just immediately turns his back and skates towards the bench while his buddy and the team captain is getting mauled in front of the net. At that point, when I saw that, it's like, well, wait a minute. I understand why the defenseman at that point would be apprehensive about going down and helping out Toews, but where's Patrick Kane? Because, again, he doesn't have to go down there and drop his gloves. He just has to go down there and grab somebody and, again, let the linesman do their work. But where was Patrick Kane? He's so self-absorbed in what he's, you know, what's affecting him that he just took off and went to the bench and never came back. You know, just an observation, you know, something to keep an eye on, because I thought that showed poor character, you know. But
yeah, I didn't see, I mean, I remember the play, I wasn't paying attention to Kane, but yeah, that is something to definitely look forward, well, keeping an eye on going forward.
Calder Trophy, Rookie of the Year, Superstar, who's got it? We got, well, why don't we just say, top candidates for this trophy, obviously Jeff Skinner, Logan Couture, San Jose Sharks, Corey Crawford, You know, Taylor Hall got injured, otherwise he would have been up there. Who would, you know, who's your pick?
You know, this is one that I've gone back and forth on. I don't think I've come to a consensus yet. I think all of them are deserving. I think Crawford would have generated a lot more pub for the award if the Hawks were even in the 4-5 spot of the playoffs, as opposed to just, you know, knock on wood, squeaking in. I think that would have raised his chances greatly to win the award, but I think all things considered, I think Couture is going to, you know, get my vote on this one.
Yeah, I mean, there's something to be said about his all-around game. Logan Couture, 75 games, 31 goals going into Monday night's game. 31 goals, 23 assists, 54 points, plus 19, got 9 goals on the power play, 8 game winners. So that's, you know, I don't think you go wrong there. Logan Couture has definitely, you know, been a huge difference maker there. A couple other guys to add to that list. You know, guy's been getting pub lately. Michael Grabner, 31 goals, 48 points, plus 15 on the New York Islanders. 5 shorties. That's definitely something that opens up your eyes there. Tyler Ennis on Buffalo. I wouldn't necessarily give him my vote. A guy that deserves a mention just because I think how good, you know, how well this guy's played. Derek Stepan, New York Rangers. Really love his game. And we talked about earlier Brad Marchand, who's a little pest and a guy who gets under a lot of people's skin. He's a pretty chippy player. Cam Fowler, you know, with his plus-minus, he's not going to get very many votes. And, you know, P.K. Subban would be there too, but kind of controversial character. But I'm going to go with Corey Crawford. I talked about it a little bit earlier. Jeff Skinner is probably going to win this award just based on age. And, you know, he's got 3 games left to get goal number 30. And that's a huge achievement for an 18-year-old kid stepping in the National Hockey League, 30 goals, not dismissing at all. It's just that Corey Crawford, first year in the league, Stanley Cup championship team, no, the Blackhawks are not for sure to be in the playoffs. They're not where they want to be currently. But realistically, at best, I think when we looked at this thing, they'd finish 4th or 5th in the conference. I believe I had them for 5th. And, you know, what are they, 5-6 points away from being that? That doesn't fall on Corey Crawford's shoulders. If it wasn't for Corey Crawford, the Blackhawks would be 13th in the conference. We wouldn't be talking about any of this. I think that Corey Crawford deserves it. I really do. It's a neck-and-neck thing. It's a toss-up. I wouldn't, you know. You want to say Jeff Skinner based on the age and what appears to be 30 goals, at least there's a good possibility. That's cool, or Logan Couture. I think any of the 3 really could get it. I'm not giving Michael Grabner anything. You know, do it on a team that plays meaningful games all year long, and then I could say that, you know, even though he's got 31, guy that was, you know, sent to Florida in the Ballard trade and then somewhat mysteriously released outright in camp, put on waivers, ended up on the island. But again, the Islanders, you know, they're playing well when games mean nothing. That means nothing to me. Show me it again next year and I'll give you some praise. Until then, I don't really care. So I think the Vezina, pretty much everybody. Is there somebody else but Thomas in your mind?
No, not at all.
Yeah, I was just going to pull it up here. I mean, Thomas, you know, we talked about it a little bit before. You know, you could throw Crawford's name into the Vezina thing. I just don't think that, I mean, it's hard to rule him out, though. You know, Corey Crawford, just based on what he's meant. But Roberto Luongo, 37 wins. You know, Carey Price, 36. You know, but you know, Fleury's going to get votes. You know, Fleury's going to get votes based on what he's meant to Pittsburgh. Brzgalov, like Adam said, that's, you know, he deserves a lot. But yeah, I think Tim Thomas gets it, and that's it. What about the Hart Trophy?
You know, I said a couple of weeks ago when we were kind of going through the Taves conversation about the Hart, you know, I threw out Steven Stamkos. I think you really have to take a look and you know, almost just coin flipping between the Sedin brothers out in Vancouver. I think we're on the same page of what the Hart Trophy is, and that's the most valuable player to your team. And I think both of those guys fit the bill out there, so I think you can give it to either one of them, and then should give it to one of them at least.
Yeah, you know, I'm going to go with, you know, again, I think this is a two-horse race, and it's either Daniel Sedin or Corey Perry. And I tend to lead to Corey Perry. You know, I think that the Sedins are you know, I just think that they're, you know, they're obviously they're a twin act, and they played a little bit of part. You know, in their career, but this year they played, you know, they played together the whole time. Corey Perry has played with Ryan Getzlaf in and out of the lineup. Bobby Ryan is, you know, he's gone through his slumps. The guy this year that's been rock solid from beginning to end for the most part, Corey Perry, 47 goals, you know, plays in, he does play in a lot of different situations. And again, you know, he's the guy. They got secondary scoring, and that's great for him. But Anaheim's not a playoff team, and their secondary scoring, it doesn't mean anything if Corey Perry doesn't have 47 goals and is leading that team physically, emotionally. And I'm going to go with Corey Perry. But, again, you're not wrong if you say Daniel. But I'm going to go with Corey Perry. Norris Trophy, that'll be the last one. Then we'll get out of here. Norris Trophy, is there a candidate that sticks out to you this year?
You know, it's been a really weird year for defensemen. You know, traditionally, it's, you know, obviously with all the injuries, and I don't know if there's too many guys that overly stick out. You know, you can always throw Nick Lindstrom out there, who's going to take my vote. I think he'll be winning another Norris Trophy this year. But, you know, the usual candidates, I mean, there's no way you're going to throw Duncan Keith out there or Mike Green. And you know, you could possibly say Chara. But I think I'm going to go with Nick Lindstrom up in Detroit.
Yeah, I'm not going with Lidstrom. I think that you know, I've kind of gone back and forth on this one. I think that the two guys that deserve, you know, the most here, the most, you know, whose impact, it was like, you know, the argument in the beginning of the year, you know, there's no such thing as a first half Norris Trophy, but who impacted their team the most from the blue line in the first half of the month, and I don't think at the time that there was any question that Dustin Byfuglien, was he the best defenseman? No, but he impacted his team the most. When you're looking at over the course of a season, it's who, you know, who was the best defenseman all around and who had the biggest impact on his team's success. Like, that's how I look at the award. And the two guys that it comes down to, Zdeno Chara and Christopher Letang on the Pittsburgh Penguins, I don't think you can go wrong with either guy. I'm going to go with Chara, although, you know, I was leaning towards Letang for a while. But I'll go with Chara. I don't think that Timmy Thomas is, you know, as great as he's been this year. I don't think without Zdeno Chara in front of him, I don't think the Boston is nearly as good as they are. And, you know, they have some holes. So I think that Zdeno Chara, plus 32, he's, you know, him and Tony Ludman, that's tops for defenseman in the league. You know, other guys to consider, Lubomir Vyshnovsky. But, yeah, and Lidstrom. I mean, you could throw Lidstrom in there. It's just, You know, to me, Lidstrom hasn't had a standout year, and that's usually who the award goes to. And I'm going to go with Chara. But if you want to say Letang or Vishnovsky, I think, you know, that's good too. But I'll go with Chara. So let's wrap up here, Superstar. What do you expect out of these four games here? What are we going to be talking about next week?
You know, I think they beat Montreal. They lose to St. Louis, and then they beat the Wings in the first half of the home and home. And I'm going to reserve the right to not pick that final game until I absolutely have to.
So you have them winning in Montreal, Montreal's final game at home this year, regular season anyway, and you have them coming. So if you're giving them a pass. It's the back end. They're going to be too tired. It's too much to ask of them to put a complete effort against the St. Louis Blues. Are we going with that again?
I'm not giving them a pass, but that's just unfortunately what I foresee happening.
Yeah, I think that they'll get a point in Montreal. I don't know if they'll win or not, but I think they'll at least get a point in Montreal. I actually see this game. Montreal's going to go one of two ways. Either it's going to be largely a sleepy game that ends in a shootout, or Corey Crawford's going to have a very difficult night, and it'll basically be, does Carey Price have a difficult night too? And Carey Price has had those recently. So I see this thing going to overtime at least, probably to a shootout. And, you know, I think that, gosh, I want to say that they're going to win the game against St. Louis on Wednesday. It's just that, you know, St. Louis, that's a game. I mean, St. Louis, that we should point out, St. Louis does play at home on Tuesday night. So there, I mean, it's the back end of a back-to-back for them too. I'll say the Hawks get a point on Tuesday. They win on Wednesday, and you know, I think you better hope that Dallas loses two games this week, because I don't see them winning on Friday night in Detroit. And I think it all comes down to it'll all come down to Sunday. And I don't think that's good news. But I'm sticking with it. I'm not going to change my mind now. They're going to make the playoffs, and it's going to be ugly against the Vancouver Canucks. That's what we're going with. So, any final thoughts?
Nope.
All right. Next Monday night, HockeyNight.com, the Hockey Night podcast. I'll be doing. We've done this every year now. A little pre-playoff. You know, preview roundtable over there at Hockey Night. So check me out over there on Monday night. And then we'll do something later on in the week, give you a little chance to take that in, and then we'll come back after game one of the playoffs, assuming it's not on Friday night. And we'll do something then. So, Superstar, thank you very much as always.
Not a problem, buddy, as always.
All right. Thanks, everybody, for joining us. And Adam Summers again at breakouthockey.podomatic.com. I'll put the link up. But thanks always again to Adam for joining us. And I don't know. We'll be back at some point. And thanks, everybody, for joining us. And good night, everybody.